This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Thank you very much, everyone. As John said, what I'm going to talk to you about tonight is potentially a new framework and way of looking at inflation, which I've called inflationary wave theory. But I would like to reiterate what John said. You quite have subtly picked up there that I am not an economist, and my background is one of social science. And the company that I run called Join the Dots is a consultancy that basically takes clients' needs and goes out, collects lots of data, synthesizes it all together, and tries to get higher sort of meaning and knowledge out of it. And literally, I've taken what we do as a day job and applied it to inflation, really. And this is the sort of resulting output. And inflation is something that I've had a particular interest in over the last few years. And what particularly got me into what we're going to talk to you about tonight was reading a book by a guy called David Hackett Fisher, who's an economic historian. And he wrote a book called The Great Wave, which was published about a decade or so ago, in it which he collates all the statistics about inflation over not only the decades, the centuries, but also in the millennia, all the way back to Babylonian times where there was inflation as well. And one of the things he finds there is that inflation is a worldwide phenomenon that seems to happen almost simultaneously around the globe. Even back in the 16th century, that's what happened. And one of his interesting charts I'll show you that really got me going on this was looking at the rise of prices in Roman times. Clearly, there was no price index in Roman times, so he's put together sketchy bits of information on the price of wheat and all these things that he could find over there. And what I think is quite interesting about that is, I'm sure a number of you may well know about what happened towards the end of the second and into the third century in Rome, where there was debasement of the currency. Roman emperors basically cut the amount of silver they put in a denarius from virtually 100% down to virtually nothing, and there was a massive inflation that resulted from it. But probably what you're not all quite so aware of is that there were actually a couple of other periods of inflation in Roman times as well, in the times of the Republic. There was one back in towards about 250 BC, which incidentally was simultaneous with an inflation in Greece and Babylonia. And there was also one at the end of the Republic. And when I looked at this chart, there was probably four things that sort of jumped out to me having looked at it. One was, if you look at it broadly, you can see over time, prices are gradually going up. Second thing is, they don't go up in a straight line. They seem to follow some sort of wave-like pattern. The third thing is, there is a sort of periodicity to that, maybe every couple of 200 or 300 years. And then the last thing is that over time, the increases get bigger. So down this side, there's fairly small increases per year, and then that last bit where they started debasing the currencies, the increases were absolutely massive. So with that as a backdrop, I then came across some other data by some British historians who've been analysing and trying to put together a price index for the UK. That's Henry Phelps Brown and colleague in the 1950s managed to dig back through all of the records of some country houses in southern England through some of the universities and came up with this data. And it's on a log scale, obviously. And what it shows, the periods of blue indicate periods of inflation and whiter periods where prices are more stable. And if you look at it, you see the same four things that we saw in the Roman data. Over time, prices are gradually going up. They follow a sort of a wave-like pattern. There's a periodicity of 200 or 300 years, obviously different every time. And the increases are gradually getting bigger. In the first one, I'm just going to move away here. The first time, over here, the increases are about 0.5% a year. Here it's about 1% a year. Here it's 2% a year. Here it's 4% a year. Beautiful bit of exponential progression as we go through time. And I was thinking, what's causing this? Why am I seeing this data? And why am I seeing this data not just in UK, but why, I'm seeing it in other data elsewhere? Unfortunately, there's very few or hardly any sources that have got any longitudinal data like we've got in the UK like this to look at. But I've no doubt that the pattern's probably similar elsewhere if you could ever collect the data for it. And trying to understand why, one of the key thoughts I had when I was looking at it, and also it's Hackett's Fisher's view, that is to think back what to a guy called Robert Malthus said. I don't know how many of you know his work. He's been slightly discredited over some of his views on life. But he was a big... he was writing... In fact, we go back here. He was writing at this time here. That little peak there. He published a book in 1798 on population. And it was his view that a lot of economic variables were correlated with population size. And one of the big issues he highlighted is that the human population has the ability to grow effectively almost exponentially, and yet our ability to find resources can only go up sort of arithmetically. And he said there's often a problem with this, really. And that one of the outputs of that is increasing inflation. And indeed, if you look at some of the statistics and try and compare what has happened to prices and what has happened to the UK population, and this would be effectively like the data, well, you would have never had the inflation indices to look at, but you've had the historical records to look at. So this chart, by the way, the red line shows you the version of the UK price index and the change in 50-year periods, and the dotted line is the change in population index in 50-year periods. And one of the things that was, you know, when he was writing, population was going up markedly, and as were sort of price indices. And you can see there's a correlation, the things that sort of caused it, things like the big drop here in the population, Black Death and failures of crops, and then you had sort of wars in towards the end of the 1600s and 1700s, 30-year war in Europe and the like. But there were big influences going on. So there's some sort of there's some sort of correlation going on here. So my first stab at this was to come up with a view that looks like this, that what is driving inflation over the very long term is some underlying trend going on, which is basically affecting demand. That's probably a very complex underlying trend. I believe that one of the key factors that is influencing that underlying trend is population and demographics. Then there's probably a lot of other things influencing that trend as well, but the primary one is probably population and demographics. But what happens is, the reason you don't see it going up in almost a straight line is that man-made factors get in, start influencing that trend, and you end up with inflation growing far greater than the underlying trend, till it gets to a point where it gets so far away from the underlying trend, or the underlying trend changes direction, that it then breaks down and it hits a tipping point and consolidates back to the trend. If you think about it, this is a very similar concept to which we see in the financial world all the time. Literally, when putting this presentation together last week, I just went out to look at Domino's pizza price. I don't know if any of you have it in your portfolios, but, you know, that's what's going on there. As they open more and more franchises over time, the share price is going up. There's an underlying trend there, but it doesn't go up in a straight line. It goes up in a zigzag. There's over-exuberance from investors and then eventually consolidation back to the trend and so on, and it's still carrying on to this day. So it's a, you know, rationally, that's not an unusual thing to think about. So why... what is driving these man-made factors? And I think one of the interesting things to note is in the very latest wave, that started around about the turn of the last century, around 1900. It was not the money, was not increases in the money supply that started this latest wave of inflation. And indeed, I've looked back through the records, and the money supply went up only about 3% from the turn of the century to the beginning of the First World War, hardly moved at all. But prices went up about 15% during that time. So it was prices preceded money supply. I'm not saying money supply is not important, I'll come back to that in a second. But so what happened there is, I suspect, the very astute investors spotted that we had got out of this consolidation wave and we were now hitting it, going into inflation. So what do? They invest in something that is going to preserve its value during the coming inflation. So you buy land, property, shares and the like. And also, if you're clever, and I'm assuming these guys were clever, they borrowed money to do it because they knew that the money that they would borrow would be debased in value over time by the inflation, and also their payments on it would be reduced. But by borrowing the money, they increased the money supply. And by doing so, they then, in time, created higher prices. And not just that, you've got that increase in the money supply creates and then a buzz in the economy. And the economy, well, there were other factors going on at that particular time because of World War I as well. But it would have created a buzz anyway because of that spurt created by that inflation. Add to that, then you've got the rest of the population. You see your house prices going up and things like that and other assets going up in like the 20s. And they pile into the stock market with high leverage as well. Follow the very similar thing. And again, by an increased the money supply feeding this around. And then you've got governments too thinking, hey, this is a good way. And the Weimar Republic and everything else follows. It's a good way of ensuring that we don't have to ever pay for our debts. So it's a bit of a potted history over why I believe those man-made factors then take off. But having said that, I mean, just to make you think that I'm not a complete lunatic here and I don't believe in monetary theory, that increase in the money supply has been very important. I mean, what this chart shows you is a comparison of broad money, so M3, M4, and an index of that taken from 1900, which is in the dotted green line. The only thing I've done is to take off that money supply and index of GDP, because clearly you need a certain amount of money supply growth to fit with the growth of the economy. So this is pure excess money supply not required by the economy. And in the blue line is the price index. And what you can see, quite incredibly, and I was quite stunned when I saw it, is that those two numbers fit almost, you know, over the long term, fit almost exactly one for one. So every 1% excess increase in the money supply equals a 1% increase in prices. And yes, there are periods when, you know, like in the 30s, where everyone was quite scared and velocity of money probably went down, where prices undershot, and similarly post-war, where they undershot, presumably because of rationing and other restrictions. But then you've got similarly periods in like the 60s, 70s, where the whole thing goes the other way. But where we are at the moment is also very interesting. In the last three decades, there's been a massive increase in the money supply. And these are on a log scale, obviously. And to get those two lines back together, you'd have to effectively double prices. It's a big difference that you're going to have to do to get those two lines together. I'm not saying we will necessarily see 100% increase in the price index tomorrow. And in fact, I think there are other ways those two lines could come together, and I'll talk more about those in a minute. But there is a big difference there of potential latent inflation. And what has happened to that money supply is it's all gone into assets. And indeed, if you do the same graph over the last 20 or 30 years and you look at the net increase in the money supply, it's almost matched one for one over time with increases in shares, increases in house prices, and increases in bonds. Almost fits. The line goes up and down a bit, but it fits almost perfectly. So that's where it's all stored up at the moment. It's locked up in these assets. But there is clearly some potential for it to get unlocked from there and back into the real world, and who knows what that might be. So trying to drag all this back together, I have some broad you, and if I was doing this to a client, I'd probably say, well, here's my sort of summary, really, of what I think's going on, really, with inflation. The causes of inflation are multiple, and lots of people over time have theorised about them, but they're probably all right in their theories, but they're all right over different time frames. So population and demographics probably have a big effect over the long term. The money supply, as we've just seen, has a big effect over decades. But, you know, what's going to shift the CPI number at 9:30 tomorrow morning, because it is 9:30 tomorrow morning, is probably going to be shifts in commodity prices or tobacco tax and stuff like that is going to be the most radical thing. So they're all important, but just over different timescales. So let's just wind back and just look at this a bit more detail to try and get a bit of an understanding of where we are now and what might happen. The inflationary parts of the wave that we've seen in the UK have lasted somewhere between 85 and 140 years. And there seems to be some slight evidence that the periodicity of the wave is getting a bit shorter over time. We are currently 115, possibly a bit more than that, depending on where you say the exact bottom was. Some people say it's about 1896, so in which case about 120 years through. So if history's got any ability to repeat itself, not only are we long overdue the point where this changes, we're only within a decade or two of probably the range of where that might be. And something will happen, and we're talking a minute about some of the things that possibly might happen to change the direction of inflation. In the past, it's been things like the Black Death and crop failures that have done it, or various wars and that have been the trigger point. And could still be things like that this time, although I suspect it's probably more likely to be a financial thing that causes the change to happen. But what is interesting is that in all of the previous ones, it seems to have been accompanied by a deflationary shock. Prices have tended to tumble around about a half in a period of a few years. And if you think you need something like that bit to change the inflationary mindset, all of us around this room have lived all of our lives with inflation. We've never, give or take the odd year of near zero inflation, we've never known anything else but inflation. Everything we do, every contract we write, every time we think about investing, we are thinking about inflation. We need something drastic has to happen to change that mindset. You know, we all have cost of living rises. They don't occur in a non-inflationary world. So something has to change the mindset. So there's going to have to be something, I think, quite big for us to transition from one thing to the other. And what probably, you know, if you look at probably what's happened in the past, it's sort of happened like this. There's often been a big rise in prices. There might have been a spike, or it just went up. There's some deflationary shock, and then various things are put in place to try and recover the economy so it goes back up. But the key thing is that the price index never gets above where it was before. And then it's sort of... So I'm not saying that as we go forward, once we hit this point, that there won't be price rises again, because of course there will. There'll be years of inflation or not inflation, depending on what the tiny macro variables are up to. And obviously, you know, in individual things within the price index will still vary. But overall, over time, as technology improves our productivity, the cost of production will go down. So prices will gradually go down over a long period of time. And if you look at what's going on in the world around us now, we're in this real seesaw of inflationary and deflationary forces. In fact, there's a hell of a lot of deflationary forces out there and reasons why prices should be largely coming to a halt. And if it wasn't for governments and their agents in firms of central bankers, I think we would be there. And in fact, I think prices around the world almost came to a halt in 2000. Literally everywhere from like Brazil that had like 2,000% inflation in 1990 came down to zero in 2000. Almost happened everywhere. And then it picked up again and then it almost came to a halt again in 2008. And I think the main reason it didn't come to a halt in 2008 was the efforts to try the stimulus responses that were put in. So we now have not only a lot of QE going on around the world, we've got a low-interest world trying to stimulate the environment, and we've still got governments doing their bit to encourage inflation. I mean, a lot. I mean, Mervyn King used to bemoan the fact that his quarterly inflation reports that, you know, it's not my fault, Gov. You know, over half of the increases in CPI are actually government regulated prices, which I can't do anything about. You're forcing them to come through. You know, think train prices, utility prices, and a lot, education, and a whole load of other things. They are under the government's remit. But having said all that, there are so many deflationary forces there, particularly at the moment. I mean, think technology. I personally don't think we have yet to see the true effect of the internet revolution. I was at a talk the other day listening to Piers Linney, the guy from Dragon's Den, and he was hypothesising that most service industries in the UK are going to get completely disintermediated over the next decade. And by that, I mean replaced by technological things, and the prices of what they offer substantially reduced. We've already seen declines in commodity prices. We still have the overhang of the financial crisis, particularly around Europe, with banks deleveraging. We've had competitive devaluations from the yen and now to the euro. We've still got the slowdown in the Chinese economy, and we're still getting floods of cheap goods coming in from various countries, particularly Southeast Asia. We've still got the problems of stagnant economies in Europe and an unemployment of 25% in a lot of European countries. We've still got austerity measures and government cutbacks. But to me, one of the biggest ones here is the ageing population and what that's then doing to consumption. Just to give you a few ideas and some figures. This is some figures that I stole out of a report from Deutsche Bank a year or so ago, talking about fertility rates. And fertility rates are actually where you need to start thinking about population if you're trying to think about modelling population into the future. To have a stable population in the world, you need to have, I think the overall figure for the world is every woman to have 2.3 kids. Though in reality, in the developed world, it's about 2.1. In the emerging markets, more about sort of 2.4, 2.5. If you look at these stats in that final column there, which is where we've been over the last 5 years, you can see that virtually all of those numbers, with the exception of Africa, a couple of countries in Africa, and they've put as a token country in Africa, Nigeria on there, are below those critical levels. So what we're saying is that even in somewhere like India, I mean, this is the average from 2010 to 2015. I don't know what the latest number is for India, but I suspect it's below 2.5 now. So in other words, what we're saying is that virtually everywhere around the globe, going forward, the population won't grow. when this feeds its way through the system. But what's going on at the same time, of course, is that everyone is getting is living longer. So therefore, it's quite difficult to see this trend going on. And Deutsche Bank carry on, next table, do their best estimates of what their population forecasts are for those same countries over the coming decades and right through to the end of this century. And when you look at that data, you can see that at some point after 2050, the world will go through peak population and things will start to decline. So this decreasing this fertility rate is going to then start to have an impact. And also, if you look at this data, you'll spot that some countries are already there. There are declining populations in Germany, Japan, Russia already. And so some countries are ahead of the others. Interesting, the stats they put in there for the UK still show it's continuing to grow. I assume that is the effect of immigration going on there. But why it matters? So not only have we got this potential for a starting to head to a declining population, but they're getting older. The average age of a Japanese person has gone up from something like 36 to 45 in the last decade or something. It's an enormous switch and a big problem. I mean, if you look here specifically about sort of Japan, I don't know if you're into these type of charts, they're age profile charts. What they show is the number of men and women for each age group. So as you go up the chart, you know, the bigger the bar, the more in that particular age group. And what used to happen in days gone by is you used to have a pyramid. You used to have loads of kids born, and gradually people would die as they get older, and you end up with a pyramid. what we've got here from Japan is like a pagoda. I mean, there's great big bulges that happened not only post-war, but again in the 60s and 70s. But what's going to happen is that those lumps there will eventually get older in another 20, 30, 40 years. They will fall off the end. And then this will then revert to being a more traditional sort of rocket cone shape or something. So it will be quite different. And why those older people matter is that older people spend less. This is ONS data on the average weekly household expenditure by age. And it clearly shows that, you know, your heaviest spending is during your 30s and 40s, usually when you've got kids. Declines a bit after that. You're still trying to spend money going on holidays and things like that, but then it declines quite heavily once you get a bit more infirm into the post-65 stage. So, and particularly, I mean, I'm not saying you don't spend a lot more on healthcare and other things like that, but that is the average expenditure. So it really does matter that the population is aging. So you've got a double whammy going on here. We've got the prospect of populations potentially even starting to decline, certainly in the developed world, and you've also got them aging. So both of those are going to have a major impact on demand. So that underlying driver is going to be change direction. So what's stopping us changing now already into this low inflation world? I mean, the main thing that's stopping us, as I said before, is primarily central bankers and their efforts to try and stop this happening. And I think they're being moderately successful for the time being. And indeed, it's possible that these guys could be too successful. I mean, we may even see a return to significant inflation before we hit the transition point. I mean, I'm no soothsayer. I can't tell you what's going to happen in the future. You know, QE could eventually, you know, that latent inflation could get itself into the economy. All it would need is a bit of a distrust of money brought about by something, and velocity of money goes up. And who knows, maybe this low interest world that we're in will produce a boom. I mean, it's not impossible, and wages might take off. And so there's a whole number of reasons. And also, commodity prices have come down so much recently. My guess is it's probably only, you know, there's a good chance they're going to go back up again. So all of those could quite significantly push inflation forward in the future. So I was trying to think over, you know, I spent quite a bit of time trying to work out, well, what conditions would need to be in place for us to go through this transition? And there's a really, I don't know if any of you read it, there's a great book written by a guy called Ronald Martz called Dying of Money. He wrote it back in 1974 in the peak of inflation at that time. And he looks back to historical times like the Weimar Republic and various other things to try and understand how did those guys stop inflation, and, you know, how could America at that time stop the inflation that was there, and eventually it came into things like the Volcker Plan and stuff like that. But his view is to stop inflation, there's probably about three conditions that are required. And admittedly, he was writing at a different time, and it's not to say that these conditions necessarily have to apply in this circumstance, but I think they're an interesting thing to have a look at. First one, his view is to stop inflation, you need to stop excessive increases in the money supply. So you need some system to not allow more money to be created than what is required by the economy. You need to get rid of any latent inflation. So we currently have this massive gap of prices having to double. So for us to actually transition, we've got to get rid of it. So we've got to double prices overnight somehow, or we've got to destroy the money supply down to it, one of the two, but for us to get here. And the third one is that debts, which are at the heart of why a lot of inflation is created, must be restructured to a sustainable level. So they might seem a slightly random set of stuff, but they're actually probably quite key conditions. So what could actually bring these three into alignment if these are turn out to be the ones that are important? I looked at it and I thought there were probably about two things that immediately jumped to my mind. One is probably a sort of a nice thing, and one is that we all get round in the world and put together something like the Chicago Plan. I don't know how many of you are aware of this idea that was brought up in the 30s by a whole load of academics at Chicago University in the aftermath of the 30s, that they basically say, well, there should be some reformation of the way money is created. No longer should it be at the whim of when someone takes out a bank loan, that it should be created by governments just at the right amount for the economy is what's required. And also they were proposing that there should be a reset and debts, government debts, should be written off, as should household debts. Quite a radical policy. Though, interestingly enough, the IMF redusted it down a couple of years ago. There's a good paper called Chicago Plan Revisited. It's worth reading, looking at it, which describes it all. And their view was actually it's quite a pretty good idea, actually, and would be beneficial to the economy. Do I think it'll ever happen? No, not a chance in hell. I mean, there's so many vested interests out there that I'd love it to happen, but I don't think it'll happen. So what's my... You know, Pete's best guess in the air of what's going to cause all these three to come into alignment, and that I think is a sovereign bond bond market crisis. In other words, a real big worldwide default on sovereign debt. And indeed, you know, I was lying in bed this morning, coming into consciousness, and on the radio I was hearing, you know, half a trillion wiped off bond markets in the last sort of week was the first thing I heard this morning as I woke up. And you think, oh, maybe we're getting there a bit sooner than I thought. Actually, I don't think we are there yet, but who knows? Who knows how this could go? The reason why I think it could solve these criteria is, you know, if you're talking of a major bond market crisis, there's probably likely to be comparatively little liquidity in that bond market, and there's a lot of leverage in it, and all of that is likely, when it goes pop, to bring down banks with great losses at that time. And it will also have reverberations through the whole financial world. Stocks will probably decline, and the house prices will get taken out at the same time as well. All of that will have a massive deflationary shock, and not only will it decrease the money supply significantly enough that it gets rid of that latent inflation, it will cause debts to have to be restructured. And also, the third is Marx's third criteria. Is a reformation of the money supply. I reckon one of the implications of it is that there will be just so much pain around the world caused by this that there will be demands that this cannot happen again. And therefore some new system of how money is created could come about at that point. Whether it's based on blockchain, I don't know. Certainly won't be based on Bitcoin. But I don't know. It's possible. That has the ability. Something like that would have the ability to sort it out. My personal guess is it probably won't be, but... something will happen. So if you think about, we are almost certainly at some point going to transition into this near zero inflation world, and what would it be like? I mean, accepting the fact that when we get there, it's going to be a bit traumatic, and we'll come back to that in a sec. But I think life in the near zero inflation world could well be quite good. And in fact, it's interesting, Hackett Fisher sort of, in his book, sort of, says that, you know, all the previous waves of where we've had these consolidation phases have all been quite positive for people. It's the age, the Renaissance was then, the age of enlightenment. Their periods, in fact, they're so generally benign for people that that's what causes people to be happy and have more kids, which creates the population boom, which starts the whole thing off again. But one of the key implications of it is that we'd stop having wage rises, wouldn't we? So the only way that people are going to get an increase in their wages is two ways, really. One is you can improve your productivity, or alternatively, you can reskill, do a better job, and move job. Those are the only two ways you're going to get a wage rise. At the moment, when most people get a wage rise, even though they know it's inflation rise, and I've done the survey, so I know... most people think it's actually their own effort that's largely driving it, even though it's called inflation. So there's going to be a big change in psychology going on when this happens. And that one could be very positive. And the other thing, if you think about it for the average person in the country, as if their wages stay, even if they stay largely static, gradually over time prices will go down. So their purchasing power will go up. So there's and together, if the transition phase is as tall destructive as the one that I've outlined as a possible scenario there, we could go a long way to sorting out Piketty's problem here, really. You know, and certainly over time, things would be heading in the right direction rather than in the wrong direction that he thought things were going. I also think, you know, that it could be quite positive for business, too. I mean, I don't know how many of you read Professor Selgin's book on, was it near zero inflation world? But, I mean, even a few years ago, he was talking about, you know, the real benefits to companies of having a more stable economic environment. I mean, I run a company, I'm on the board of one. I mean, trying to work out where the economy is going and trying to time our work around the economy's cycles is a pain. It would be great not to have to have a much more stable environment. And one of the problems with inflation is it masks what's going on in reality. I mean, arguably part of the problem with Tesco was the fact that their turnover and profits and that were being flattered by inflation. You take inflation away and the emperor's clothes is left behind, and we've all seen what happened to Tesco. And I just think it makes for better decision-making, because it's just simpler. You haven't got this other factor going on, and you don't have to pay costs to change your prices all the time. If the certainly if the transition period is a destructive one, we will probably get through a lot of zombie companies at that time eventually. And, you know, the whole thing could end up with more investments. And there's a number of reasons. But one of the other problems that we need to think about if we do end up in this world is, at the moment, inflation is a very good, subtle, indirect tax. I mean, I've done some calculations. Up until last year, the UK government was benefiting somewhere to the tune of about $30 billion a year from inflation in a hidden tax. Obviously, this last year, with inflation sort of going to near zero, a lot of that's disappeared. But if you assume long-term inflation's going to go away, you're going to have some other tax to get to substitute that. And there's not many options you've got. One of the ones I put at the top of this group here is tax and savings. I mean, when I created this chart, this was last autumn before we'd got into negative interest rates. But now we've got into negative interest rates, we've actually got that one already. We are, in some countries, we are charging for holding money. There's the possibility of wealth taxes, though I suspect in the UK, now that we don't have a Labour government, they're probably decreased. And similarly, I thought it was possible we might see an increase in death taxes, but again, Conservatives have promised that's not going to happen. So that doesn't leave many options. So to me, increased capital gains looks quite a likely one, because someone's got to get this money from somewhere. So that between that and taxes on cash and savings, I think those are the ones I'd be looking for. So all of this suggests that I'm just going to end now in terms of like, okay, so what does this all mean for me? Well, by me, you, all of us around the room in our own personal lives, and how do we then take this information and use it in any useful way to manage your wealth? And my bottom line answer to you is that it's going to be tricky if this plays out vaguely as I think it might play out. Not least for the fact that we're not quite sure when the whole thing goes pop, because something's going to change. But anyway, let's play with what I've got. In the current world that we're in now, I'm going to call it a low-flation world. I reckon because of the way that central bankers are working, that I wouldn't be at all surprised to see low interest rates persist for decades or for a long time until something stops them. And also the efforts to stimulate the economy with money printing will probably carry on and be passed around. So all of that, to me, is going to be good for shares and property while this merry-go-round goes round. It's going to carry on being incredibly bad for any holders of cash. And obviously, gold I probably put into that category as well. And bonds, I don't think they can, unless the world really does go insane and we really do all accept negative interest rates, I'm not really sure I see them going that far in any direction in this world. But when you hit the transition period, all the cards get thrown in the air, particularly if it's a negative one, which I think is probably almost the most likely scenario, because clearly there'll be a massive destruction of wealth across most of the assets that we all hold. And the only thing that might do all right at that time is probably if you're holding gold under the thing. But the problem with gold, you know, what happened in the 30s in the financial crisis over there, the government just basically said that you can't hold gold anymore. And a lot of gold that people are holding is in paper gold, and those derivative contracts will probably go pop as well. And even if you're holding cash, which you think is a really good idea, the chances are that if this really does cascade across the many banks, as it probably was, those compensation schemes for 85,000 are not going to pay out. In the small print of the Bank of England a few years ago, it was very clear that there would be a bail-in if this really did, the big one did happen. So I think the moral there for your cash is hold a bit of cash, buy some assets when they reduce in price, but before the government can catch up with you, really. So just be nimble. so keep it for a short time, spend it quickly, on the way down, probably. And then what happens in the longer term, once we hit the consolidation phase? Well, this is an interesting time, because I think long term, shares come back to the front. But what's interesting is that what has driven share prices forward, certainly in the last two or three decades, can be almost explained 100% by the money supply. The rises there almost completely correlate with excess money supply. So if you've got a world where excess money supply is not happening, the capital value, average capital value of shares probably won't go up much in that world. But what you will get is dividends. And you'll probably get dividends of 2 or 3% a year. But if you're living in a world of average minus 1, minus 2 inflation, that's a total return of 4 or 5%, which is almost exactly spot on what the average returns have been over the last 100 years after inflation. We had a return of 9, 10%, but we had to deduct 5% inflation, 4 or 5% inflation from it. The number's the same. So, interesting place. And obviously, some types of savings would work, but probably what won't go up during that time is property and things like that. And God knows what will happen to bonds. Will anyone ever trust a bond again if that's going on there? I don't know. Or they'll probably be structured in a different way. FinTech will deal with that one. So just to sort of like try and draw this together, I mean, one of the other interesting implications is I do wonder whether one of the implications could be that money just might revert to being more of its original purpose, really, a method of exchange and store of value. In other words, it will stop becoming something that money can create money, which we've been in this strange world over the last century, and that whether a bit of that will come to an end, not at all, of course. And here is my quick summary chart, really, over impact of wealth during these sort of three stages. And the summary chart, basically, a plus means it's good, a minus means it's bad, and a double minus means it's very bad. And a zero means sort of, I don't know, negligible. But what the key point about it, right, is that, there, you know, if you're doing a traditional buy and hold strategy across some various assets, it's not really going to work. You're going to have to be a bit more nimble in the forthcoming time, would be my guess.